when you have money, when you have network with the Western, with Americans, you have the power to do anything.
You are armed to the teeth, submachine guns, grenades. Your job was very much a security.
I point guns at people, start locking load at people, and then turn them together and they would actually fire.
They were conquerors, and for that you want only brute force. Nothing to boast of when you have it, since your strength is just an accident arising from the weakness of others. They grabbed what they could get for the sake of what was to be got. It was just robbery with violence, aggravated murder on a great scale, and men going at it blind, as is very proper for those who tackle a darkness. The conquest of the earth, which mostly means the taking it away from those who have a different complexion or slightly flatter noses than ourselves, is not a pretty thing when you look into it too much.
Hello and welcome to the Occupy Sydney podcast series on resource exploitation. That was an excerpt from Joseph Conrad's Heart of Darkness, first published in 1899. Conrad based his novella on the atrocities he witnessed while serving as the captain of a Congo steamer during the time of King Leopold II's brutal colonial rule. People often say that this period in time in history was merely a phase. We would like to consign it to our past, to think that the West has moved beyond its shameful colonial brutality. But the truth is far from that. On the 24th of November last year, over a century since Conrad sailed the Congo River on the Roi de Belge, a small group gathered in front of New South Wales Parliament to protest what is happening in the Democratic Republic of Congo. This is what one of the protesters had to say. The stakes are very high in Congo for the multinationals. Children are dying. They are raping women. Congo is one of the richest countries in mineral resources. We want to pass a message through, because some people are living in a comfort zone of ignorance. Nobody talks about it. Nobody cares. The situation in Congo might seem worlds apart for many Australians. And yet, just a few hundred metres away, overlooking Sydney Harbour, sit the offices of Glencore. Its CEO, Ivan Glassenberg, is Australia's richest man. Glencore buy copper mined by child slaves. But they are just one of the many multinational companies making huge profits by exploiting the people and resources of Congo. And those resources find their way into every part of our industrialized economy. Over the next three episodes, we're going to look at a pattern unfolding in many parts of the world where some of the worst human rights abuses imaginable are being committed, where the environment is being destroyed and poisoned on a frightening scale, where democracy is stifled, corruption rife, and all this misery in places that have huge resource riches. This subject is a can of worms. The deception is mind-boggling. The level of injustice is vile, so we can only begin to scratch the surface. There are many hotspots around the world that we won't even have a chance to mention. So please check out ocidpodcast.org for the full content of the interviews and for further information. In this episode, we look at the conflict fueled by the resource trade. First to the Congo, a country that has suffered the bloodiest conflict since World War II. Now, to understand the present situation, we need to look at the past, back to those shocking horrors witnessed by Conrad. When King Leopold II of Belgium took the Congo as his own property, he transformed it into a prison labour camp run on terror. He made massive profits from ivory and rubber. The Congolese people were conscripted into forced labour gangs to collect the rubber sap. Leopold created an army to enforce strict production quotas through a campaign of violence. Each soldier would be given a set number of bullets, and had to prove that he had not wasted the bullets by bringing back the severed hand of their victims. They had to account for every bullet, so if a cartridge was misfired or lost, or only injured a person, they would hack off the hands of those who were still alive, and it didn't matter if they were women or children. Villages were routinely burnt, plantations were destroyed to starve people, minor infractions were punished with mass beheadings. Women were taken as hostages, tortured and raped and brutalized. All that mattered was that the rubber production continued. A commission system paid officers bonuses on the basis of production. Bonuses were also paid for recruits into military service. Now, when Edmund Morel discovered what was happening in the Congo, he said, "I had stumbled upon a secret society of murderers with a king for a crony man." Morel and others started to reveal the shocking reality of Leopold's Free Congo State. He started the Congo Reform Association and campaigned to voice out what was happening, to tell the truth. And he made it front page news. Now, this was the first humanitarian organization in history. Now, this is the really sick part of it. When Leopold went to Congo, he told people that he was on a humanitarian mission. It was all very calculated. He even studied the legal basis of how other European colonizers had dispossessed people of their lands. And he went around conning the traditional owners to sign away their land for bolts of cloth. He told them they were signing friendship agreements. Then when the atrocities came out, he paid journalists and writers and set up propaganda offices and published lies to subvert what Morel and others were revealing. Now, this is important to understand because those who are exploiting today have had over a century to perfect Leopold's techniques. Now, the pressure of the Congo Reform Association forced Leopold to sell Congo to the Belgian state, and the Congolese people suffered under colonial rule as the Belgians continued to extract wealth. Then in 1960, Belgium officially handed Congo its independence. Patrice Lumumba, a leader of the independence movement, rose to become the first democratically elected prime minister of the independent Congo. Lumumba stood against the covert imperialism that continued after his country had been officially handed back. He intended to use Congo's riches to make his people prosper. Now, this posed such a threat to the interests of foreign powers that not one, but several assassination plots were hatched. By this time, the US had a substantial stake in the Congo. The uranium mined at Tenke Fungureme was used to manufacture the atomic bombs dropped on Hiroshima and Nagasaki during the Second World War. The CIA had a plot to poison Lumumba, which was authorized by President Eisenhower. The Belgians had an assassination plot called Operation Barracuda, which they officially apologized for in 2002, not of their own volition, but after a historian, Ludovic de Witt, had exposed their role, which led to a new parliamentary inquiry. The British ambassador in Leopold at that time, Howard Smith, who later became head of MI5, also wanted Lumumba killed. So you had a confluence of major powers plotting to kill this democratically elected African leader of a sovereign country. A CIA cable sent from Bronson Tweedy, who was the head of the African division, to his agents on the ground in Congo, just a few months before Lumumba was murdered, states, "Our primary concern must be the concealment of American role." So these various intelligence apparatus schemed to have Lumumba killed in such a way that they could deny culpability for it. Then on January 17th, 1961, after being beaten, tortured, humiliated, Lumumba was shot dead by an execution squad. The US then installed Mobutu, a paid CIA agent who would become a dictator for the next 32 years and run the country into the ground. It is also important to note that Lumumba was framed as a communist in the Western media, almost as a way of manufacturing consent for America's role in the region. I spoke to Patrice Niembo, a human rights activist born in Congo, who came to Australia as a refugee, spent 3 years in detention, and attained citizenship here in 2001. I asked Patrice about Mobutu and the history of Congo up until the present day.
He was fulfilling their requirement by keeping safe their interests. After using him, they bring another Congolese in the name of Kabila, Laurent Désiré Kabila. And when he was there, he looked his own people, he empathized with them, he changed and was trying to build the country. After 3 years, they killed him and They brought a so-called his son, Joseph Désiré Kabila, but his true name is Kaname, Hippolyte Kaname. He used to be a bodyguard of Kagame, the current president in Rwanda. And from 1998, the invite, it means Rwanda, Uganda, the invite Congo with the meat of Tutsis, and they start to pillage the resources till now, and supporting by the Western and the CIA, which I can say America. Till now, we are under occupation of big powers. Recently, in November, the people of Congo went to the polls and they elect their own president, which the big power, the big brother, couldn't accept. They maintain still the loser. Till now, there is a lot of people who are dying. Something like over 6 million people died. If I have a good memory, from 1998 till 2002, 6 million, and every single day, 1,250 lives of Congolese are just going without put in consideration all of the fight which been taken, for example, in the villages, in the cities. It's now even more than 9 million people, but the world still look away.
The mineral wealth of Congo is estimated at $24 trillion. Coltan, cobalt, zinc, pyrochlore, cassiterite, copper, kowazite are just some of the resources that multinational companies are exploiting.
All of those new material which we are manufacturing now, like mobile phones, like laptop, all of those little electronic devices can be found, their sources in Congo.
Kawama is a small village in the south of Congo. The ancestors of that village found precious green stones, malachite, and they thought these stones would bring their people great fortune. In the local language, Kawama means, one day this place will be prosperous. On the 24th of November, 2009, the villages of Kawama were forcibly removed, brick houses bulldozed, as people slept in them. A 10-year-old boy had his leg crushed by one of the bulldozers, and his family were too poor to get him medical treatment. People were shot at, some were killed, and those who survived fled in terror. This action was premeditated. It was carried out by the South Katanga Mining Company so they could get access to exploit the lands for its mineral riches. The villages are still being blocked from their traditional farmlands and are now literally starving. They have received no justice, no compensation. Now, the company EGMF, who owns a 60% stake in that mine, are a subsidiary of George Forest International. George Forest, just as Leopold did in his time, masquerades as a philanthropist. According to Forbes magazine, one of George Forest's greatest philosophies in life is giving back to people. This is how these companies do business.
You know, when you have money, when you have network with the Western, with Americans, you have the power.
Military power and mining interests are closely connected. Late last year, a group of geologists under the auspices of the US Department of Defense compiled a report on rare earth elements in the Helmand province of Afghanistan. Now, the Helmand province is a flashpoint for conflict and currently supplies 75% of the world's opium. The geologists were flown in on Black Hawk helicopters accompanied by heavily armed US Marines. They were working from maps that had been developed by Soviet scientists in the 1970s to assay for rare earth elements. China is currently the dominant supplier of rare earth elements, producing more than 95% of the world's output. China's dominance of REEs is a concern for the Americans, because REEs are used in high-technology consumer applications, laptops, mobile phones, plasma screen TVs, solar panels, catalytic converters, batteries, wind turbines, and the like. But REEs are also increasingly important in military applications, including fighter jet engines, aircraft components, missile guidance systems, electronic countermeasures, underwater mine detection, anti-missile defense, range finding, and space-based satellite power. Cobalt, mined in Congo, is another strategic mineral of the US military. Cobalt is a hard, brittle, metallic element which can be used in superalloys. Now, the superalloys have superior heat resistance, high strength, wear resistance, and superior magnetism. The sort of things you put in jet engine parts, tank armor, and mining equipment. But in addition to this large-scale military-industrial complex, it is also common for rank-and-file military officers to be directly involved in resource exploitation. For example, both in West Papua as in Congo, military personnel might own timber concessions, or they might be running small-scale mining operations. I spoke to Nick Chesterfield, editor and one of the founders of West Papua Media, an organization that aims to break through the media blackout and bring credible reporting from the ground in West Papua.
West Papua is an occupied territory by the Indonesian military and the state. It's been occupied by a military that derives only 20% of its income from the state and the rest of it has to raise through private means. So what this has meant in the 50 years of occupation is that the military sees West Papua and land, forest, minerals, and all the resources of Papua as its booty.
So you were saying that the Indonesian military is 80% funded by these private corporations. Who are they?
It's 20% funded by the Indonesian state. They reckon they've lifted it up to 29%, but there's no proof of that at this point. So it's not just private corporations that fund the Indonesian security forces. In fact, there's some quite creative accounting that goes on to prove that they're not doing that, but they are. But Indonesian military are the world's largest organised mafia. They conduct protection rackets on little people, they conduct protection rackets on indigenous businessmen and also foreign corporations working in the country. You know, they're a classic mafia model. Air Force generals own timber concessions, army generals own timber concessions, police officers own timber concessions, intelligence officers own timber concessions. So most of them are involved in illegal logging, which are generally small-scale operations run by each sort of local military or police command, but they also run small operations of illegal gold mining, what's called artisanal mining. So they get local people in and pan the gold, and then they sell them the mercury, they sell them the panning equipment, they sell them the accommodation, the chemical. And then situations like the illegal gold mining trade around Freeport, the tailings, they also bring in all the equipment, food, cooking oil, rice, noodles, and prostitutes. And every police officer has got a little, and military officers got a little bit of the side project going along.
So just going back to the Indonesian security forces, how would one join the security force in Indonesia?
Usually it's the only thing there is to join. A lot of Indonesian military personnel come from small villages. Each village will have a military officer in it. It's called the territorial command structure, and it's part of the Dui Fungsi, which is the dual function of the military. In both social and defence affairs, they see themselves as the backbone of the nation, and so they involve themselves in every single social activity there is, which a lot of people object to, but at the end of the day, they're the only ones who can pay their soldiers anything. see it as a, you only guarantee that someone, you see this all the time across Indonesia, one child gets sent to the military, one child gets sent to the police, one child gets sent to the customs or a civilian part of the government, and that way it's both an influence thing and it's a breadwinner thing. There's not that many people that work in private. So it comes from basic economic need when the military and security forces are the only ones that can provide the jobs. There's a very strong attraction for people to join it, and then they're brainwashed from the second they join. So it's quite easy to join. To rise in the ranks whilst maintaining ethics and care for human rights, now that's a different story entirely. Corruption is seen as the natural order.
And you were saying before that there's Australian forces in West Papua. What are they doing there and who sent them?
There have been reports of Australian forces, but we've been unable to verify that exclusively. There's been a reported existence of a new unit of the SAS who have been putting themselves in places where, you know, small teams who go out and gather intelligence or work with local forces. But certainly the Australian government provides arms and training to the Detachment 88 counterterrorism group. In fact, we completely fund Detachment 88. It is our baby. It comes out of the Australian Federal Police budget. There's a great article from our friends at New Matilda that people can have a look at. About just how much our money goes to aid and fund torture with Detachment 88. So, Detachment 88 are used as a counter-terrorist group in Indonesia. They just recently killed a whole load of suspects for terrorism issues in Bali. We train them for interrogation, anti-terrorism work, but they're also used against separatism and against peaceful free expression quite regularly. There's been reports of being used in West Papua against protesters in Bima, in the Sumbawa mine, Australian-owned Sumbawa mine that was recently the site of a massacre by Indonesian police. Yeah, so the Australian-trained and armed troops are certainly there. We've also funded Kapasus and Special Forces and trained them. And we also fund and train Brimob. So our fingerprints are all over it. And of course there are Australian mining companies in Paniai in particular. And of course the reason this Papua has invaded the giant Freeport mine, 41 or 42% owned by Rio Tinto. So, which is a giant Australian mining company. And Rio Tinto also regularly use Australian mercenaries for their security operations. A company called FBIS International. So, they also use Executive Outcomes, Sandline mercenaries, and all sorts of nasty, what they call security contractors these days.
It was recently revealed that the SAS have a secret squadron deployed in Africa, Squadron 4. Now, apparently the squadron has been mounting dozens of operations over the past year in countries like Zimbabwe, Nigeria, and Kenya. But we still really don't know what these SAS troops are doing in Africa, although it has been suggested that they are there gathering intelligence, surveying the physical and political landscape to prepare for potential future military intervention. Now, I can't understand why elite soldiers would be used for intelligence gathering. These are highly trained fighters. They are instructed to follow orders above anything else. Now, the first part of the entrance test to the SAS has the troops stripped naked, almost as a ritual of submission. And SAS troops routinely board planes without even knowing their destination. Australia's secret military presence in Africa should be a concern for all Australians. Now, although we don't know what the SAS are doing in Africa, there have been numerous reports of what Indonesia's elite troops, trained by Australia, are doing in West Papua.
So you were saying before that there seems to be a bit of a momentum gathering for the West Papuan movement. What are some of the strategies and techniques that the Indonesian security forces and the mining companies have implemented to try and crack down on that movement?
One of the key things they do is every single demonstration that happens, every single public gathering, they'll surround the gathering with heavy armour. So heavy machine guns, armoured personnel carriers, artillery mounted light tanks, that sort of stuff. Every Bremont police officer will carry a machine gun. That's just their standard complement. So every single demonstration, you've got hundreds of troops ringing, sometimes thousands of troops ringing each demonstration. They'll point guns at people, they'll lock and load at people, they'll pull out pistols and point them and pretend to shoot them. And then, obviously, in certain gatherings, they will actually open fire whenever symbols are used or whenever particular words are uttered. One of the things they're absolutely terrified of, the Indonesian security forces, is display of the West Papua Morning Star flag. It's a flag that will get you put in jail for 15 years if you display it. So one of the key tactics, of course, is, you know, before a demonstration happens, they'll send a car with mobile phone monitoring equipment through a marketplace, and they'll scan for keywords. These things can actually be deployed in cars now. And they target keywords and scan for keywords, and then they'll basically go through a mobile phone and pick out all the telephone numbers that are stored in a mobile phone's memory. One of their classic tactics is they just send around these huge campaigns of SMS harassment. So quite regularly, activists will get sent SMSs saying, "We can kill you, we can kill your family, going to end up in a ditch, this is what's going to happen." And then this generally worries people, but it doesn't stop them. One of their big tactics is arresting anyone and throwing them in jail and charging them with subversion. And of course, then there's what we call the ninja tactics, which are really nasty, where they'll, a group of men dressed in black, usually special forces, will just kidnap someone randomly off the street. Not necessarily an activist, just someone who fits the part. Women are usually targets in this. They'll torture them, they'll rape them, they'll brutalise them, they'll leave them with significant injuries. And then they'll release them straight into the middle of the village. There'll be no explanation, there'll be no apology, there'll be no accusations. They just dump them there. Everyone knows who does it, and then they basically go. You know, they're a walking warning to the rest of the people. Stand up for West Papua, and this is what you get.
Former military personnel are often targeted for recruitment by mining companies. In 1975, Lance Priestley was a recently returned Vietnam veteran who was offered a job driving trucks in Papua New Guinea.
The particular run that we were being hired to do was between Port Moresby and Goroka. You'd go up in 6 to 10 truck convoys, and the entire drive was virtually uphill. And you were armed to the teeth, like submachine guns, grenades in each truck, and you were under specific instructions that if the truck broke down, you pushed it over the side, using the other trucks to do it. You just pushed that truck over the other side, grabbed your weapons, and jumped on one of the other trucks. Your job was very much a security, and you had two drivers to a truck.
And how did the pay for that kind of work compare then to the average sort of job?
Look, the a really good job back then paid $300 or $400 a week. The bottom rate was $2,500 a week. I guess they must have really wanted trucks.
In the Congo, foreign nationals working in mines often have a dual role of security.
Those people, they are not only workers, they are also mercenaries. They can turn also to the mercenaries to keep the interest of those big corporations. They are not only workers, but they have also other agendas.
Are you saying that there are foreign workers who come in, work in the mines, but then also have the capacity to become a sort of private militia?
Yep. Only there for working as cleaners, as shopkeepers, no. That's why their salary, it's very interesting than the local people. Their wages, it's quite good because they are doing security, and in case they can defend the interest of the corporation, their company.
How?
They can fight. I have some examples. When I was there, military, U.S. Army, was working there in metallurgical compound. He was not only a worker there, but he was a security guard. And his behavior was very bad until the local people discover, when they were searching him, they discover like he was a soldier. He was not only a simple worker, he was a soldier.
You've been listening to Robbery with Violence. We've been talking about resource exploitation and conflict, and we've only covered a very small fraction of this topic. Please check out the extra links and documents on our website, ocidpodcast.org, and get involved. In the next episode of this podcast series, we look at the massive environmental destruction caused by resource exploitation.
It is a matter of physics, and not of opinion, that this depressurization will affect the whole groundwater system.
They come to the realization that crop fertility isn't assisted at all by petrochemicals.
And it's such a vast area of extremely important climate stabilizing land that's being destroyed.